Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holidayinstall to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is a terrific critic and podcaster and a regular presence right here on the One Heat Minute Productions podcast network, where she is a frequent guest and the co-host of the Miami Nice pod. She also reviews new releases for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times, and is the vice president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Her byline has appeared at GQ, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, Playboy, Vulture, The Wrap, Mel Magazine, The Playlist, Nerdist, Slate, and many, many more. Please join us in welcoming the wise and the wonderful and the wet-headed Katie Walsh. Hi, Katie.
Thank you so much. Hi. Wow, that's the first time someone's called me wise.
I mean, I think of you as as a person of tremendous wisdom, personally.
Thank you so much. It's so nice. I appreciate that.
So one thing that I didn't know about you before putting down that bio is that in addition to all of your film writing and teaching and moderating and podcasting and all of the things that you have to do to scrounge together a living in this business,
yes,
you've done a bit of producing as well. And
kind of, yes.
Well, I do. I always like to ask critics who've ventured over to the other side of that screen, how do you think that experience informed your work as a critic, if at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had so many different life experiences in film before I became a critic. Like, I actually just celebrated 10 years of being a celebrated. I just noticed that it had been 10 years since I'd been a full-time critic.
You didn't have, like, a party? You didn't
myself,
have cake and
what?
Streamers and the whole night?
Yeah.
Surprise! Happy birthday to you. Yeah.
No, not even an Instagram post. Wow. Not even a blue sky post.
Imagine.
I had, like, a full-blown kind of career, actually, in PR.
Ooh.
In film publicity before I've always said that my career has been very Goldilocks, like too hot, too cold, just right. I had to eat every bowl of porridge and test out every bed before I sort of landed doing this. Mm-hmm. My first job was actually at Lionsgate in the film publicity department in New York in the mid-aughts.
Okay.
So I think that has really informed how I work as a critic, because publicists are like our number one colleagues, actually. They're the people we're emailing every single day.
I was going to say nemeses, but yes, colleagues. That's a much nicer way to put it. Yes.
Yeah. You know, I try to keep it friendly and nice. Like,
that's much wiser.
Please,
yes.
Please work for me,
yes,
and we can work together.
Yes.
And then when I was working at Lionsgate, I had a friend who was a videographer at Nylon, and she was making a short film. And so she was like, hey, want to produce my short? And, you know, when you produce someone's short, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, heavily using air quotes here, you just do whatever. Like I think my most significant contribution to the film, aside from like ordering burritos and pizza, was I said let's have a meeting at my local bar, which was in Brooklyn at the time. It was called Brooklyn Social. It's in Carroll Gardens, and we had this drunken meeting, and the writer director Rebecca was like, she kept pointing at the bartender. She's like, we gotta cast someone like him. And eventually we start talking to the bartender. He's an actor, of course. And he ultimately was cast in the film. So I think that was my most significant contribution. But it actually does lead directly into how I became a critic, which is that the film went to South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. Hilariously, like, our entire cast and crew went to South by Southwest for a short film. Mm-hmm. There were like 10 of us. And she was actually dating Rodrigo Perez at the time, and he went to South by Southwest, and he was running the playlist, which was literally just him. Yeah, it was just him, like, on Blogspot, like a couple other guys maybe, and he was like asking all of us. We just went to every single movie, every single party, and I was like, "Oh, I'm going to be an indie producer," which, like, you have to be independently wealthy.
Right.
You have to be indie wealthy.
Absolutely.
To be an indie producer.
Yep.
Which I was not. And I just had no idea what I was doing, but I had quit my PR job at that point. And Rodrigo just said, "Hey, I didn't get to see all the movies. Can you guys, like, write up little blurbs for me?" And me and my friend were on the plane writing little, like, paragraph long film reviews about the stuff we had seen. And those were my very first film reviews that I ever wrote.
Wow.
But I do think, like, having a variety of experiences is so important as a critic. I think if you don't know, like, how hard it is to make a movie, mm-hmm. then I think it's easy to be, like, really snarky and dismissive.
Yeah.
And, like, to me, I'm just sort of like, everything, if you finish something and
it's
put it out there,
fucking,
like, that's
miracle.
A miracle.
Yes. Yes.
It's a miracle.
Yes.
So I try to, like, come at it from that perspective. And I think it helps a lot. I mean, I think I'm maybe sometimes, like, a little bit too nice. I'm also very mean when I feel like it. But I think it's, like, really important to know how things are made and that it's really hard. Yeah. So yeah, that definitely has influenced my work.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm quite a failed filmmaker before I did this, and I agree with you 1,000%. It makes me nicer, but it also, when something is really bad, I'm angrier about it, because, damn it, you got an opportunity, and you blew it sometimes, you know?
Yeah, or just, like, for me, I think a lot of it is, like, when I can tell that there was no pushback on, like, bad ideas. If I see, like, written, directed, produced by, starring, edited by the same person, I'm like, red flag, because it's a collaborative medium and somebody has to say, like, this is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Or something. Like, you're not a genius.
No.
You know, there's very few people that kind of can, like, earn that title, I think, and not have it be a red flag that they did everything on the movie.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing your critic origin story with me. It's fascinating.
Yes, that's my superhero origin story.
So, Katie, what film did you select from Guide for the Film Fanatic to discuss with us today?
I chose Christian F.
Okay, so this is fun, actually. This will be a lot of fun for the audio-only listeners, because the entire trailer here is images from the film, no dialogue, and the Bowie song. Like, so
the dialogue's all in German anyway. You motherfuckers wouldn't understand it.
It's true.
Exactly.
You might as well just listen to Bowie.
I always assumed that this was,
that's such a good way to sell this
movie. It is.
Though.
It is. I'd always assumed that this was like a Miramax era invention, like the foreign film with the no dialogue trailers to hide that there's no English in it. But apparently it was at least used this time before. And I did notice when I was doing the research for the episode that the newspaper ads for the American release in 83, like literally say like Christiane F. And then it's at the bottom, it says with David Bowie, as if it's like The Hunger and he's like full on co-star. And it has like the image of him on stage. They were very much using the Bowie angle to sell Christiane F.
And then everybody walked into that theater and said, oh no, oh dear, what have I gotten myself
I thought
into?
I was watching David Bowie sing for 2 hours. What's this depressing stuff?
Well, right. Somebody came in and had a pitch with a poster that said Panic on Needle Park for a new age. And everybody was like, nah, bro, Bowie. Let's go with the Bowie angle.
They said underage Panic on Needle
Park.
There
Thank you.
Yes.
Woo. But yeah, that's the trailer. And audio only listeners, I hope you enjoyed hearing Heroes. Christiane F., the story of a nice girl who makes some questionable choices, was originally set to be directed by Roland Click. He was best known at that time for Deadlock, a very good German spaghetti-esque Western. So I don't know, what would that be, like a bratwurst Western? 2 weeks before
Pretzel
the
Western.
Beginning of Prince... Pretzel Western, there we go. 2 weeks before the beginning of principal photography, producer Bernd Erdlicher fired Click from the project and brought in Ulrich Edel, usually billed as Uli. It was his feature directorial debut. The screenplay was by Hermann Weigel, adapting the 1978 nonfiction book, and oh boy, here we go, Wir Kinder vom Bahnhof Zoo, which also serves as the picture's on-screen subtitle.
That was really good.
Hey,
actually.
Thanks. I guess I've watched. I guess I've watched enough Fassbender to fake it. The book, which was edited by German journalists Kai Hermann and Horst Reich, was comprised of interviews that the pair conducted with the real-life Christiane F. and several of the underage heroin addicts and sex workers that comprised her circle in the Berlin underground. The film adaptation was low-budget and consciously attempted to replicate the nonfiction aesthetic, using mostly non-actors and even some real addicts and sex workers, many of them also underage. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about Christiane F. in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
This has to be the shortest one we've had, right?
Some are brief. This is a brief one, yes.
Yeah. Controversial, grueling film. Let me hit that word again. Grueling film based on actual transcripts about a pretty, neglected 13-year-old girl, Nacha Brunkhorst, who befriends a group of young street people and takes a nosedive into the sordid world of heroin addiction and prostitution. Let me hit that word again. Nosedive into the sordid world of heroin. I had never seen this movie before. I watched it for the first time like 2 hours ago. This movie fucked me up. I'm sorry. I am emotional right now. Film is extreme. That part wasn't from the review. Film is extremely graphic, unrelenting in its grimness. Unrelenting in its grimness. Believable. Saddest part is that Christiane's mother loves her, yet still lets her get all her emotional support from other kids who aren't even strong enough to help themselves. God damn you, Danny. Bro, right to the gut, this guy. Watching the brutal change in Christiane's facial appearance is as shocking as the other sights in her disgusting world. Obviously not for all tastes, but it stays in memory. With a concert appearance and music by David Bowie, one wonders why director Ulrich Edel, who doesn't pay much attention to character development, was attracted to such a morbid subject. Also with Thomas Haustein as Christiane's hustler addict boyfriend, Jens Kufal. Now that is how you appropriately credit David Bowie in this movie. He gets one line about 80% of the way through the write-up.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, so let's...
Michael, I'm very sorry that I made you watch this movie. I feel like 80% of my movie recommendation life is apologizing profusely to people for it. So, well, this is not new to me.
Well, walk us through, because, you know, you sent you had a few choices here, but walk me through your personal history with this particular movie and why it jumped out at you to talk about.
Well, firstly, I had just seen it for the first time a couple weeks ago on the big screen. There is a 4K restoration that is traveling around, I think, different theaters right now. It played at one of my favorite film festivals, which is Bleak Week in LA. Actually, Bleak Week is now international. Right. It's in seven different cities, but the American Cinematheque hosts Bleak Week. And I actually did not get to see it at this year's Bleak Week, but they played an encore. So I went to the encore. But this was a movie that I've been hearing about for years.
Right.
It's kind of a cult film.
Right.
It was very, very hard to see for many, many years. I do think, you know, with this 4K restoration that they'll probably be putting it out on physical media. I actually rented it from my local video store, shout out Videotech. And Mark, the video store clerk, was like, he was like, it's in Spanish, so you have to like go to the German language and then put the subtitles on. It's like, he gave me some like Spanish Blu-ray of Christian F. I was like, does this even play? Like, so it's really hard to see, but it always had that kind of like cult, hard to see, you know, it's about really fucked up shit kind of allure to it. Yeah. And so I really wanted to go see it. And at the Bleak Week screening, Sean Baker introduced it. So I didn't get to see Sean introduce it, which I'm really sad about. But that kind of also put a new layer on the film for me while I was watching it, because I was like, this is so obviously like a huge influence on his work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think this might be the first episode that we've done where like all three of us just saw it for the first time. I sort of, the way it goes sometimes is, you know, like as Katie did, sometimes the guest will send a list of like sort of like five or six favorites and be like, you know, maybe one of these. And honestly, this one jumped out at me because that restoration was currently playing in New York. And I was like, sometimes you need the excuse of doing something for work to make you like go see something you actually want to see. And so I was able to like justify it. It's like, hey, this is for the podcast. So yeah, so I went to see it at Lincoln Center a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, and it was really, it had that same allure.
What did they say when you were like, hey, can you pause it? I need to go outside for 15 minutes and like take a fucking breath. What did they, were they up for that? Because I had to do that like three times.
They were not.
Oh man, that's rough.
Suggestion.
They need a Lincoln Center, like they need a, like an emotional screening where they pause it every 20 minutes.
Right. They should. They should. The sick and twisted thing is that I was like going through it, and you know, you're going through it with other people in the theater. Like me and the guy next to me were like having a hard time at certain aspects. But I also at the same time was like, this, I love this. Like,
no.
This is so my shit.
Yeah.
I just love Bleak, the hardcore, like upsetting stuff like this. I don't know why. I truly cannot explain why. I just love it.
I mean, I feel like you got to be careful, because I don't want to make it sound to a listener who maybe hasn't seen it and is contemplating it, like it's not a full on, it's not like a funeral dirge sort of situation. Like there is pleasure in it. There is electricity in it, especially early on. Like you that's kind of par for the course for your cautionary drug tale, is like you have to give some sense of like of what the initial attraction is, what someone is seeking and finding in this substance or in this subculture or in the people she's around who are doing this. And I think, I don't know, I think that's something that this film does really, really beautifully. Like that, and I actually clocked it. She doesn't ask for her first shot until 45 minutes in to a 130 minute movie. So like, they're not rushing you right into this. They're setting a scene. You're getting a sense of a time and place, and really, truly, in a way that I think is pretty masterful, getting to know her. And I think it's an incredible performance. Like, maybe that's where we start, is this extraordinary young actor who's playing the role, Nadja Bronkhorst, who plays Christian F. I think this is a tremendous performance. What are your thoughts on her work in this, Katie?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's, you know, it's one of those, like, you know, kind of lightning in a bottle, like, how did they shoot this kind of performances? This is also the kind of film that, like, I got back to my car and just sat in my car for 45 minutes reading about the movie.
Yes.
Because I knew, you know, it's that kind of thing where you're just like, this is real. Holy shit.
You're like, no, no, somebody really went through all this? Oh, Jesus, no. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, who is the real Christian F? Who is Nadja, you know, what's her last name again? Nadja Bruckhorst. Like, you know, how did they do this? And, like, honestly, a lot of it was illegal. You know, a lot of the scenes, you know, there are, like, sex scenes between, or at least one, between her and her boyfriend, Detlef, and they were both underage.
Yes.
And
the laws at the time were that they just had to have their parents' permission. And I'm like, that seems like a flawed law, and I'm glad it changed.
Right, exactly. I actually also read that there were a couple of scenes where she's soliciting, you know, on the street in, you know, to guys in cars. And there was one scene where they were shooting her from a really long lens.
Oh no.
And a real car drove up, and the crew starts running towards her screaming, "No, no, no," because it wasn't
that's not an actor.
A fake.
Just some right. guy who it wants wasn't... to fuck a 13-year-old. I mean, oh
yeah.
my God.
Yeah, and the thing is, she looks 13.
Right. Oh yeah.
Like
right. oh yeah.
She looks like a child.
The first time she goes to that club to sound. The sense in that scene of playing dress up, you know, that she's wearing like all this makeup to look older.
Like a Bratz doll, like way over.
Yes.
There. Right.
Yes. And it
the blue eyeshadow, red lipstick. It's like clownish. Almost.
It's unnerving because it only actually makes her look younger, you know? And so, yeah. And that, but that really is, that's sort of where this story starts, that all she wants in her social life is to go to sound, and then she goes and it sucks, which is the most relatable thing in the movie for me. Like, I felt Christian so hard for that. although I will say there, you see a couple of times when they're at sound that there's a cinema built into sound, and like, man, I would go to nightclubs all the time if they had cinemas built into them. I'm just putting this out there.
What's going on in sound?
You just complain about the music. You'd complain about the beat from the dance floor. Like, I couldn't hear the movie.
You're right.
Yeah.
We're trying to watch Carnival of Souls.
People
in here. Can you turn it down?
Out.
Yeah. Totally.
It's very relatable also, you know, the fact that it is so simple that she falls into this harrowing addiction over a dumb guy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
She just is so obsessed with this guy, Detlef, who's very cute. And he's doing heroin and she wants to keep up with him. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, no, girl, no. But you know that this is where it's going. And you know, I like that they don't quite overcomplicate things in that sense. So you can kind of just take in the world and the journey and all these horrifying things that are happening. But yeah, like, I think it is a good point that you make that, like, yeah, it's very hard to watch, but it's not, there is a reason why we are compelled to watch
totally.
It. Like, the street kids are kind of cool and sexy and cool outfits and, there's this part where there's a scene where they're like running around and running from the cops and going up on this roof. And, you know, you're feeling the exhilaration of like this youthful rebelliousness.
Totally.
And how intoxicating that is.
Yeah. And the music, I think, is a huge part of that. The music, the Bowie music and the other sort of more terrifying stuff is so propulsive. There's just something that's so indelible about the way that like the beat is pounding, and that you get this beautiful night photography and you're on like elevated trains, and there's a feeling that it captures in those early passages that I don't think I had felt since I was a teenager, which is that very specific feeling of being out all night when you're not supposed to be. Just that little thrill.
Like, you remember
like,
when you could still like smell 1 a.m.?
Yes.
Like, it's still, there was, you know what I mean? Like, you can't smell it anymore because you got too much shit on your mind, and I've been smoking for 40 fucking years. But when I was a kid, you could smell 1 a.m., it smelled different.
Yeah. And that was,
that's such a good way to put it. Yeah.
There was, there's such an energy to feeling like, ooh, I'm not supposed to be out here, and I am. And I'm with all my friends, and we're all so cool. And that the feeling of that rooftop scene brought that back to me in just like a really forceful way. I don't want to say like, I get it, but I kind of get it. The line that sort of made the most sense in terms of understanding the movie is when he's showing her the little DIY tattoo, and she says, "Did it hurt?" And he says, "Yes, but I was bored." And I'm just like, well, that's teenage ennui in like 10 seconds. It's intense.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. 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 There's a lot of really indelible feelings to that. But then at the same time, they so cleverly are intercutting these reminders that she really is like a literal child. Like that fade into the 14th birthday cake, like put me backwards in my seat. It's like, oh, right. Fuck. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The cake is really an intense moment. 'Cause yeah, you're kind of like, oh, she's out having fun, and then it's like, oh no, this is how old she is. Mm-hmm. And then she has, I think it's Babsy who's over, and she takes a bath, and she's smoking and eating the cake in the bath, and it's just you're like these little feral children. Like, I kept trying to sort of place it in like post-war Germany, like. So her parents were born during the war,
sure.
And if they were 40 something, and she's 14 now, so she was what, born? This takes place in the mid 70s, so she's born in 1960 or something. And I don't know. I don't know if I'm doing the math right.
No,
but,
that sounds about right.
Or they were born right, you know. And so it's like, I'm like, what is the German national
character
psychology at this point?
Yeah.
Well, they were a fucking mess. They were a fucking mess. They had, I mean, the country was split between Russia and the States for the longest time. And then they finally fucked off. But it was still like, wait, who is running things? The whole half the country was spies at that point. Like, it just everything was a mess. Like, it took them almost until reunification to really like sort of control their own society again in a way that made them feel like they actually had some agency. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, this is book learning. It's not like I was there. But that's my understanding of it is that, you know, we're basically sort of between like 45 and 90, like it was just this struggle to redefine their identity against what everybody still basically thinks of them as. I mean, like it's still very easy for us to be like, well, of course the fucking, you know, fascists are taking over Bavaria. Have you ever read a book? Like, that's what they do. Like, we could do this all day, right?
Sure.
So I think that they were really trying to still make that point and struggle against that in a way that can feel hopeless if you're not, you know, whatever, grown and like have, you know, a backbone and parents who are in place trying to help you. Like, I, you know, obviously people are getting hooked on this shit all over the world, but I do think that there was a sort of like, what's the point anyway sort of mindset that was available to people in that hard stretch, because it's not like things, I mean, if the movie's in what, 76 77, it's supposed to, it's not like things were great anywhere. Russia was a mess. The oil embargo was fucked up. Like, the United States was like trusting Jimmy Carter to fix things. Like, just everything was terrible everywhere. Mao was about to die. I mean, my God, like, how is a German teenager supposed to be like, and this is the way forward? It's this movie's incredible. Right. This movie's incredible.
So
I'm glad we got there.
Yeah.
I'm glad we got there, Michael.
No, it is like it's. Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, will I ever watch it again? I don't know. But they really did it. Right. They really, really did it.
Yeah, I think I read that the real Christiane F. was kind of upset that they didn't show as much of her family background as was sort of accurate to her real life. Because, you know, they show that she comes from a broken home. Her mom has a new boyfriend. It's sort of like light neglect. Mm-hmm. But and I think it was probably worse for her, you know, in real life. But I almost like that they just kind of don't dive into like the family psychology of it and are just sort of like trying to capture this world because it's almost bleaker that she's like kind of okay and has like a nice mom nice-ish mom who's just sort of like benign neglect but her mom does get her to detox the one time with Detlev, which is maybe the harshest scene in the movie.
When she pukes in his heroin, I was like, this movie's I can't take it. That's, what is that movie with the, what is it, where Ethan Hawke pours the milk of magnesium into his whiskey or something? No, pours the bleach in the whiskey. This is like the thing that gets anywhere near her puking on his heroin. Oh, my fucking God. Yeah.
But I also appreciate that they showed the whole detox process because you're like, this is why you don't want to do this stuff.
Yeah.
It's a cautionary tale.
Yeah. Well, and even strangely, like, that's such a harrowing moment. But the image from the detox scene that I think I'll remember the most is her ripping that wallpaper. It's just like, it's such a perfect, it's such a perfect visual encapsulation of a mindset in a really unassuming and unexpected way. And as I'm watching her just tearing at that, I'm like, oh girl, you are in fucking trouble. And it does, like, it does. Once she sort of takes that shot, just once, that's what they all say, at the 45 minute mark, that is when things start to get really bleak and really hard to watch, and they do not soft soap the grimy details. It is a tough movie to watch if you're one of my people who get a little woozy at the sight of a needle. I glanced away from the screen a fair amount.
The next time somebody says to me that Goodfellas is a cautionary tale, I'm going to tell them to send this movie to Scorsese and try fucking again, because I'll sign up for the Gambinos 10 times before I take a fucking needle after watching this movie. All right, I'm done.
I think the worst part, like, there's a lot of really bad stuff that happens in the movie. Mm-hmm. The worst part, the part that everybody was squirming at, was like the dirty needles. Mm-hmm. They're washing needles in public toilets. They're sharing needles. Mm-hmm. You're sharing needles from guys who you're like, please, this man, do not use his needle. Mm-hmm. And it's rough stuff. Mm-hmm. So the sharing needles, the dirty needles is the worst part. Mm-hmm.
Then this comes out in like 82, 83, right? So if you are having a chance to see it, you're seeing it bong dead as the HIV epidemic is, like, people are really starting to understand it, which just makes that, I mean, it's like gross and sort of icky when they're filming it, right? But like, by the time people are seeing this movie, if they are, you understand that's you're absolutely killing yourself,
right?
Yeah
right.
I mean, I think we're all coming at it from that knowledge of, you know, post HIV, or not even post, but like that, you know, from that knowledge of sharing needles. And so it was a different time.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask, I mean, it could have been, we've all seen, you know, bad, melodramatic, overwrought anti-drug movies. We've all seen Reefer Madness or Desperate Lives or any of the many after school specials. And this, like, it could have been that. And I don't know, maybe in English it would be. Maybe that remove helps. But what do you think makes this work as a genuinely sort of harrowing and effective drama, as opposed to didacticism, basically?
I think it's the really unflinching gaze of it, but it's non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. I did not find the exploration or the camera to be judgmental. I mean, it's mm-hmm. taking it all in, and this is why I think this probably speaks to Sean Baker. Mm. There's a scene where she's looking for Babsy. Mm-hmm. And like, I am sure someone could disagree with me on this, but there's a scene where it's sort of towards the end of the film where she's looking for her friend Babette, who they're all in the throes of addiction and always trying to, you know, get out of it. But I think at this point, Detlev, who is a gay hustler, is living with his boyfriend.
Yep.
So she's kind of on her own. And it's just the camera just is kind of following her around, roaming around this station, because all the drug addicts and sex workers would be in Bahnhof Zoo, this train mm-hmm. station. And it was kind of at this moment where it's like, okay, this is the Sean Baker of it all. The sort mm-hmm. of like, I want to capture this subculture, these people who inhabit this subculture. And while you're watching it going, oh God, these kids are in rough shape. Like, I did not feel like the filmmakers were trying to exploit them or judge them.
Right.
And so I think that the film is extremely unflinching, and it presents everything and all of its, you know, gory details, but it is not necessarily asking you to like tisk-tisk at right. it in a way. I don't know. I mean, and maybe some people might. That might be their reaction. Like, everyone's going to have a different reaction to material like this. But I just found it to be very like open and curious about this world, which is kind of how I felt wanting to watch this movie, was right. like, I'm curious about it.
Right. I think, too, I agree with everything that you're saying. I think there are there are choices that Adele makes in the filmmaking that really heighten that sense of observation as opposed to judgment. I mean, I think the most obvious one is how much he's using handheld, especially in the sequences like the one that you're talking about, the stuff that's in Zoo Station, that he's really shooting that stuff more like a documentarian than like a conventional filmmaker. Certainly partially out of necessity, the fact that they really were just kind of like there shooting real people and we're not getting a lot of retakes or opportunities for coverage or things like that. But what really jumped out at me was the choices he's making about sound. That it's not that he's not using music. Obviously, there's all the Bowie music. It's not that he's not using score. There are moments where score is deployed quite effectively. But the scenes where he chooses to make us sit in not quite silence, but in like the sort of natural sounds of these horrifying situations, how long they sit when she first gets high in the car after the concert, how long it sits with her in that eerie quiet, that sort of distortion that starts to take over the soundtrack, like you're hearing what she's hearing. That's really unnerving and powerful. And he does the same thing in that withdrawal sequence, that he resists the urge to put in plinky sad music or anything like that, that it's just like the really uncomfortable sounds of two people going the fuck through it. You know what I mean?
I think other filmmakers would give you that kind of like sad, like exactly what you're saying, like sentimental. They would, you know, try to tell you what to think about this mm-hmm. with score or sound. I think you're totally right that he's just presenting it and allowing you to draw your own conclusions. And so that, I think, is a great choice that he made.
Sentimental is the word, isn't it? There's nothing sentimental in this movie whatsoever. And that's part of like what it is to really like sit in it. I hadn't put that word to it, but that's the right word. Okay. Sorry. You're a writer. That shouldn't be a surprise. Sorry. Nice.
No, but it's true. It's not a sentimental presentation of this. And, you know, a couple years ago, Prime Video did a remake of this. It was a series.
Whoa.
And I have not watched it. Yeah. It's called, I think, We Are the Children of the Bahnhof Zoo. I think it's something like that. But
okay.
But I've only watched the trailer, and it's not the same.
Yeah.
It's not the same. you know, it's like rock and roll fashion and not period accurate at all. And I think it might be German language. But I'm actually so curious to watch it and see how different it is from this film. I mean, you know, this film was a huge cult hit.
Sensation like, in Germany.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, I'm not surprised that they want to remake it. Yeah, I was also reading that girls were really obsessed with her fashion and her look, and they were trying to imitate her vibe. And I think people started to get really like, oh no, like don't copy her too much.
Only one way to get that pallor, kids, and you don't want it.
Yeah, heroin chic, indeed. Yeah. But it was a huge sensation. But I'd be curious to see how to compare the series and this. So,
God, I would be afraid it would feel like vinyl, and I would just want to throw. You know what? Right? Wasn't that the show
that was the show?
Yeah, 70s. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. It looks a little cartoony, or not cartoon, like costumey. There I guess would be the right word.
There you go. I did want to say, I think my favorite filmmaking choice that he makes, and Adele is a weird filmmaker. I looked up his filmography, and it is just all over the fucking place. Because like he did this, and he did Last Exit to Brooklyn, which I think is another Bleak Week selection. He did the Bader-Meinhof Complex, which is very good. But then he also directed Madonna's Body of Evidence. Remember Madonna's Body of Evidence? And he directed.
Yeah, he has a weird.
Yeah. He did a Jonathan Limnicki movie called The Little Vampire, like a kiddie movie. I don't know if I want to see a child movie from the director of Christian F. And like TV, like episodes of Twin Peaks and Oz and Tales from the Crypt and Homicide. Like it's a peculiar filmography. But my favorite thing that he does is they go through that harrowing withdrawal. We go through it with them. There's, as we've mentioned, there's vomiting in heroin. There's wallpaper being peeled. They come out of it. They look happy and healthy. They go to their friends. They're like, hey, we kicked it. And they're like, great, we're going to go get high. And then he completely skips ahead. He spares us the entire second descent. We don't need to see it. We know how it happens. We saw it the first time around. And we then see the next time we see them in that next montage that they are now worse this time around. And that's such a brilliant choice. I wanted to like applaud in the theater when he did that. Really good.
Yeah. I think the most important thing you see is them deciding like, oh, should we go with them? Oh, you know, and they go, oh, well, we know we can get off of it.
Yeah.
And then it like cuts to them just like mess, worse, homeless,
fucked up,
sex work.
Yes.
Bad.
Yeah.
She's always carrying a plastic bag of something. I was like, what's in the bag?
That's a choice. That's a real choice. I admired that choice. I mean,
it's probably like all of her worldly possessions.
You ever seen a homeless person without a bag? I mean,
no, it's true. Right? It's true. I just was always like, what's in the bag? Like, she's kind of put together-ish. And she just has one plastic bag. I didn't know what was in it. But anyway, it's a mess. But you're right. That's a great choice to not show, oh, here we go again. Yeah. Another shot. Getting high again.
This is where we came in.
Us the fun part of getting high. He has to show us the bad part of getting high.
Yep. And now it's worse. Okay, gang, let's take let's take a quick break, and then we will talk about the movie's release and reception.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. see a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holidayinstall to get started. Lowe's, we help you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Christiane F., which opened in New York City on March 19th, 1982, a little over a year after its German opening. Also opening on that day, a very different portrait of teenage life and vice, Porky's, as well as Blake
Edwards.
That
movie could have used some heroin.
It sure could have. Sure could have. And maybe a few more characters dying, to be honest. Also opening that day, Blake Edwards' Victor Victoria and Sidney Lumet's Death Trap. Also in theaters that weekend, Personal Best, Making Love, Missing, Shoot the Moon, One from the Heart, Quest for Fire, Death Wish 2, and Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip. Also still playing from the previous year, because this is how it used to work. You could still go out to the theater to see Raiders of the Lost Ark, Absence of Malice, On Golden Pond, and Reds. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Friday, March 19, 1982, a washed-up actor who was bested by a monkey in most of his movies was somehow also the President of the United States, and he was ruining pretty much everything he touched. On the front page of the New York Times, he was complaining to the National Association of Manufacturers that their CEO should quit telling people that his massive tax cut was going to ruin the economy. I don't know if I've ever co-signed for a room full of CEOs in my life, but this one's a pretty easy call.
They were correct about that.
Former Israeli consul Chaim Rosenthal announced that he had paid $40,000 for a collection of 700 letters and two diaries by chicken shit loser Heinrich Himmler from a former Nazi officer then living in Mexico. There are various stories about how the purchase actually came about, mostly revolving around disgraced shitbag Carl Wolf, who was Himmler's assistant, and he robbed him blind as the ship started sinking because fascist rats have no loyalty or decency even amongst the people they call friends. It is like, I am embarrassed to say I've read a lot of these letters, and I just rage read them, and I'm right, he sucks, and every one I read, I'm like, yep, this guy is a fucking loser. But I read another one. I don't know why. I can't figure it out. All right.
Finally, we're doing a German movie. You were doing some show prep.
That's it. And finally, the Perry County School Board in New Augusta, Mississippi found out they were losing $186,000 in federal funding for their district because players were being discriminated against on their high school basketball team.
Oh,
now, this is the monkey actor's Justice Department, remember?
Yeah.
Anyone want to guess the nature of the discrimination charge?
Oh, you
already fucking know. According to one student's father, there were no white kids on the starting five. So he complained to the coach, who started playing white kids on the starting five. Then the team started losing. They lost their number one ranking, dropped down in the rankings. So he went back to starting the black kids, and guess what happened? They started winning again, and then the parents of the white kids sued. Welcome to the fucking 1980s. This is the thing. Take heart, everybody who's living through this thing that we're living through right now for the first time. If you didn't live through the 80s, I know it can feel like all of this is really like genuinely new, but they did all this shit before anyway.
Garbage, dude.
The news from this year is just terrible. Thank God there were movies. Jason, what did the critics say about Christiane F.?
At the Times, Janet Maslin wrote, "The fact that Christiane F. has been one of the biggest moneymakers in West German movie history says much more about West German audiences than it does about the film. She called it a, quote, sad, sordid look at the horrors of drug addiction, and horrors is the operative word, and complained that the film, quote, concentrates almost entirely on the sensational aspects of its story. It makes very little effort either to develop sympathy for its heroine or to account for her grotesque decline. There's no corresponding insight to accompany its squalor."
Go watch a fucking musical, Janet. What do you want?
In Time, Richard Corliss wrote, as Christiane and her boyfriend Detlef, Thomas Hosteen, spiral into the lower depths, the movie becomes as exhausting and repetitive as a reprobate's confession. But this is screenwriter Herman Weigel's point. There is no drama in this drama. No rush, no reason, no alternative, no future. The junkie's world is not a series of adrenaline highs and remorseful lows. It is one endless anguish. The victims are zombies, gray-faced, living dead. Director Ulrich Adel hews to a semi-documentary style, but his message is out of the classic German monster movies. There is a golem inside us all, and its name is apathy. End quote. Ooh. In New York Daily News, Rex Reed opined, This might be overselling the product. For Christiane F., in my opinion, stands a chance of encouraging drug abuse because of the attractiveness of its two young stars. And it's...
No, and it, Rex.
I mean...
Sorry.
Sometimes it's so wrong, you gotta put it in the roundup. And...
I know.
It's pot-smoking, opiatic haze of David Bowie music just as much as it pretends to reduce drug use by the terrifying portrait it draws of heroin. Either way, it is a hair-raising, voyeuristic descent into the bowels of hell for people of all drug persuasions. It is certainly not boring. That's something. And in the Village Voice... Carrie Rickey furthered this criticism, writing, quote, it reduces drug lowlife to convenient good-evil polarities. Some do not, and they're good. Some do, they're evil. In Christiane F., heroin is associated with David Bowie's music. He makes a brief appearance headlining a concert that seems to have been designed by Albert Speer. Homophiliac sex and sadism, it's reefer madness without irony. As with the drug film screened for stoned-out high schoolers during the 60s, you have to laugh at its cliché, obvious assumptions, its chilling lack of understanding. A two-word review, cold turkey, end quote. So I had a hard time finding an American review that I thought aligned with my own views on Christiane F., but sometimes you just can't.
No intellectual curiosity whatsoever. I mean,
it's like they want reefer madness, or they want like to be over explained to.
Right.
I feel like Corliss maybe got the closest.
Yeah, he did.
But everyone's like, oh, you don't feel sympathy for her. I felt so much sympathy for her. And maybe that's just in the casting and like having this young, sweet-faced girl and just watching her go through this. But like, I just felt for her the whole time.
Yeah, no, I feel like that's, if I may paraphrase my favorite Boogie Nights quote, I feel like that's a YP. That's not an MP.
You
can't sympathize with what this girl's going through, then let's look in your heart a little bit. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
The only time I didn't feel sorry for her was when she was having the cake and cigarette and the bubble bath. That looked pretty good. That was pretty boss. But everything else, across the board, awful. Let's see. As Miss Maslin noted, the picture was wildly successful in West Germany, topping the year's box office. It was also a sleeper hit in U.S. art houses, where it was released in both subtitled and dubbed versions. Much of its success here was thanks to David Bowie's participation. His involvement was heavily trumpeted in U.S. newspaper ads and posters. It was not nominated for that year's Best Foreign Film Oscar, which was won by Hungary's Mephisto, another big U.S. art house hit of the early 80s, though it won the 1981 Montreal World Film Festival, as well as the German Golden Screen Award.
So there you have it. All right, now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Katie, you're our guest, which means you get to go first.
So I was thinking about this, and I know it's kind of obvious, but I think I'm going to choose a Sean Baker movie because I think
that's great.
That he, just thinking about how he, like, I really did see this movie's influence on his own curiosity about the world. I'm having a hard time deciding which one though, because I think when you think about the sex worker aspect of it, you want to go Tangerine, you want to go Anora, because I think Sean's movies are, they're not as bleak as this. Right. Like he has a sort of, at least in Tangerine and Honora, there's sort of a more warmth, yeah. I think, you know, in the outlook. Mm-hmm. But I do think Red Rocket is his most sort of like bleak, cyclical, like this person's never going to change kind of movie. I think I am going to go with Tangerine, though, just for more of the like cityscape, people on the street kind of vibe. There's no heroin, or I don't think, in Tangerine, but I think I'm going to go with that one. The curiosity about a certain world, yeah. that not everybody sees all the time or tries not to see. I think Tangerine is my choice.
Yeah, and definitely that really perceptive thing you said earlier about the sort of non-judgmental perspective of his work that's very much present in this one as well. Yeah, that's a good pick.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Thanks.
I have an even more obvious one, so don't feel bad. When I'm watching the heroes sequence, when I'm watching them like running through the mall and just being like young and hot and running from the cops and the music is blasting, and I'm like, oh, well, Danny Boyle watched this a lot of times before he did Trainspotting. Like it, that mixture of the sort of the electricity of the early passages, the way that it captures chosen family vibes, the way that it gets the initial draw of addiction, the fun that you can have getting high with your friends, and then the descent and the extent to which he's willing to wallow in the muck and the grime and the grossness that inevitably occurs. It was very, very clear to, like, I played a little bit of sort of spot the influenced all the way through this movie. Like as a U2 person, like the whole Zoo Station thing was like the first thing that jumped out at me when that's like right there on the title card. I was like, oh, okay. But you know, there's definitely DNA of this in, you know, Kids and White Girl and Requiem yeah. for a Dream and all of your sort of like youth getting high and behaving badly stuff. But I think stylistically, and in terms of tone, Trainspotting aligns pretty closely. So that it would be a tough double feature, but I think it would be a good one. Mike?
Well, I'm going to come in with the most obvious one of all. It's so obvious, I'm going to have to cut it out of your answer, which is fucking Kids, bro. Like, it's the only sure. movie that, like you so you talked about how like they are willing to just sit with these people and let them be on high, let them be high. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how many yeah. movies, I mean, Kids does that, but also they're literal children. And right. they're doing a bunch of shit they ain't supposed to be doing. And right. most of the time when that happens in movies, you have a sense that, you know, they're rebelling or there's something like that. The kids aren't rebelling against anything. They're just fucking bored.
Right. Right. And there's that line. There's that line coming back. Yep.
Yep. I've just always felt like if those kids had a fucking, like, you know, basketball coach that they got along with or something, you know, they wouldn't have been there, you know. But I also yeah. like, I had a,
now there's a movie I want to see. There's heartwarming basketball.
That's kids movie. I think
in West Germany in 1975.
I think the Weinsteins really missed an opportunity for the Kids sequel there by not doing the Coach Carter Kids mashup. I think you're right about that, Mike.
I had invited a friend to come to this movie. She couldn't make it, but she had brought up, that just popped into my head when you were naming those movies. She goes, oh, this looks like Heaven Knows What.
Yes. The Safdie Brothers movie, that's a good one too. Which yes.
also is based on a, you know, true story of the girl who stars yes. in it. And,
oh man. Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a clear influence also in that film as well, which is, I think even, I'm not even sure how much fun that movie has.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in a long time, but I don't remember. I remember that being kind of a tough sit, yeah. whereas like Christiane, you know, it's got the David Bowie.
There you go.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, Katie, where can people follow you on social media and read your work?
Yeah. So I am on Rotten Tomatoes. So I review movies every week for the Tribune News Service. All my reviews are on Rotten Tomatoes, so just search me up there. But I also link all my reviews on Letterboxd. My handle is Katie Walsh STX, and I'm on Blue Sky, and I post my reviews on Blue Sky. So Katie Walsh STX is my social handle. So please follow me on those platforms.
I've always wanted to ask what the STX stands for or stands in for, or the meaning of the handle.
STX is the airport code for St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is where I am from. I was born and raised in St. Croix, and my parents still live there, so I go back all the time. And yeah, so it's for St. Croix.
I had no idea. That's so cool. Thank you for that. A long time social media mystery solved on our program.
A lot of people just learned that for the first time. You've just done a bit of journalism here.
Yeah, it's funny because like all my friends and siblings and parents and like my mom's social handle is her name STX. Like it's my best friend's social handle is her name STX. We all have STX in our social handles.
Nice. I love it. Now I know.
I'm not very original. Everyone's copying me.
I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
At Guide for the Film Fanatic on YouTube, where you can see me reading the news, oddly enough.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please leave us a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get our weekly show notes and links and all sorts of fun stuff, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation and support us in the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And if you're one of those weirdos who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, you can find us on YouTube. Hello, if you're watching on YouTube. Find us on YouTube. The channel is Guide for the Film Fanatic.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Coward, who made it very clear to us that he only jerks him off.
Thank you again, Katie.
Thank you, guys. This was a blast.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. On the next Guide for the Film Fanatic, John Malahai, author of the new book Rewinding the 80s, Cinema Under the Influence of Music, Videos, Action, Stars, and a Cold War, joins us to discuss one of the most 80s of all 80s movies, Paul Brickman's Risky Business. See you then.